Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Coat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews.
By students, for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
It's the Short Coat Podcast. I'm your host. I'm a host. I always say your host. It's very egotistical. I'm a host, Dave Etler.
The host.
I'm here with Dylan Todd.
Hi there.
I'm here with Mark Torrell.
What's up?
I'm here with Christina Sloan.
Hey.
And I'm here with Eric Elliott.
Hello.
This is the MSTP podcast.
Yay.
Welcome, MSTP students. For those of you who don't know, MSTP stands for Medical Scientist Training Program. And basically, they train students to not only be doctors, but to be world-class researchers. Do you feel world-class at this point?
We're getting there.
Depends on the day, maybe.
Anybody not feel world-class?
Well,
I feel pretty world-class.
I figured. You fit right in.
Yeah. Before we get started, I want to remind our listeners that we have a voicemail number. There's a number of ways you can get in touch with us, but voicemail is one we particularly like. You know why? Because we are an audio podcast, so it's helpful to. And somebody actually did get in touch with us this week. I'm going to play a question. We'll talk about it. How about that?
Sweet.
Okay.
Here we go.
Hi, Dave. My name is Jenna, and I recently married a man who is applying to med school right now.
What a terrible idea.
And I wondered if you guys could talk about a little bit what couples can do before med school, prepare for med school, and during med school, what types of things the spouse can expect that the other spouse is going to be going through in med school, and what ways we can support them the best. Thanks, Dave.
That is a fantastic question. We have had, in the past, relationship episodes, but I went and looked back, and I realized that they're quite a bit distant. So last time we did one of these was September 2013, and it was a lot of fun. You can go back and listen to it. There's even one from, I think, episode number 2 from 2010 or something. I don't know, something like that.
Hmm.
Which was a very funny episode, as I recall. But anyway, do you guys? How many of us are in? How many of you are in relationships right now?
I am.
Oh man!
Nope.
So just me.
Nope.
What a miserable crowd to answer your question.
Yeah.
How many of you have been in relationships during med school and are now no longer?
Just to
bring up something awesome. Okay, so. Do we have any basic advice for Jenna?
So I mean, both as a female and so I am now married as well, and I met my husband in med school. He's since decided it wasn't for him, but it gives me kind of an interesting perspective because I was in med school simultaneously. And so I think the biggest thing that you can prepare yourself for is that you're going to have a lot of patience because your husband is going to be stressed out of his mind frequently. There will be really bad test weeks where sometimes you will probably feel neglected. And if you can kind of prepare yourself that will happen, but it's okay. Another thing that I would say is kind of helpful is if you can set aside specific times for the two of you. So if you say, the evening after he has a test, if you guys have a little date night or just something to make sure that you do remind him that he has a wife and that she loves him very much. And then I think little things like having a pre-made dinner, especially the night before the test, where it's okay if he just eats it and then runs away to back go and study. A lot of understanding can go a long way, I think.
Yeah, I think building off that, kind of what you're saying, like setting aside specific time is really important, because something that a lot of people run into, and I know I did just kind of looking back at med school, is when you start, you see it as discrete episodes of busyness, and you're like, you know what, I just need to get through this test and then I'll like have more time. Mm-hmm. Or I just need to get through like just studying for this board exam and then I'll have more time. Or I just need to get through this rotation. But you don't really get that much less busy. It just kind of builds on in different ways. And I think if you follow that mindset, you're kind of deceiving yourself, and it can be helpful. And again, this is, I guess, a little bit more for your husband's perspective, but that's just something important to think about. And that all along the way, you want to be thinking, like, how am I going to set aside time? How am I going to balance these things? And that's just something important to think about. As a little aside, making him food would be, like, the best thing ever. Mm-hmm. Like, just being able to, for him to, like, have meals that are made to, like, take or, like, come home and eat. Because, like, I did not have that, but that would have been, like, fantastic. So, just little tips.
What's wrong with a little lean cuisine, man?
Yeah, I'm not a lean cuisine kind of guy.
It's okay, but, like, a good homemade meal, so
it's just, it's a different, yeah.
Yeah. When I was studying for my boards, my then fiance, now husband, we had it set up where I had all this time set out where I was studying, but we had this, like, 1 hour a day where it was, he would come to my condo and I'd be studying and he would make dinner. And then when it was my dinner time break, I'd come down and we'd hang out for an hour. And it was just like intensive us time. And then I'd go away and study again. So it was like scheduled, but it was also something that I looked forward to. And so in that respect, like, if you have these times that are specifically, this is us time, this is date night, like, it will be something that he looks forward to, that it's a break. And
yeah, I think that's definitely a good idea.
I'm wondering if it's a good idea. It's probably a good idea to take a look at the personalities involved.
Oh, yeah,
too,
because, absolutely.
Because I know that when I get stressed out, sometimes I can only focus on the thing that's stressing me out. Mm-hmm. Like, no matter how much I may want to focus on my kids or my family, my wife, the fact that my roof is leaking, the only thing that I can think about is the thing that's stressing me out, and that's a personality thing. You know, like, some people are good at compartmentalizing, some people are not, and so
like the Titanic, I just, like, I have all these discrete cells, and, like, you'd really have to rip across all of them to cause the Titanic to sink. But yeah. Oversharing.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good. But, you know, there's just going to be sometimes when, you know, no matter what time you have set aside, you're going to have to also forgive that person, maybe.
Oh, absolutely.
When it's not, just not possible for them to do the focusing that you decided to do at that time.
And that's what I was trying to say about, like, being patient and hopefully being forgiving, because there will be those times. It was for me, and I imagine it was for you guys too, that, like, there's just days where, like you said, you cannot focus on anything else. You are just, if I don't study this entire time, I may fail this test. Mm-hmm. Like, and it just
it feels like that every week.
Well, it does, but there are some times that are worse than others.
Yeah.
I've known Eric Elliott for roughly 5 minutes, but I'm thinking he might be cool as a cucumber when under stress.
I don't think that's really
true. No, you don't think that's true.
You always seem to hold it together pretty well. Like, there's sometimes that you seem a little stressed, but, like, there's people that when they get stressed, they get really...
Inside Eric's a seething cauldron of hate, though.
Possibly, yeah.
I tend to lose a lot of weight when I'm stressed, so it maybe manifests physically more.
Yeah.
So pay attention to Eric if he's looking particularly skeletal. You know, he's got a problem. He might need a hug. Yeah.
Are you guys in the same MSTP class?
We are. Okay. We entered fall of 2010, right?
You guys are approaching the end.
Right. Hopefully.
Yeah. Well, good luck.
With regards to that question, I think there are definitely times where people are more or less available in med school. Mm-hmm. I think particularly after tests, a lot of people feel like it's a good time to
relax. Yeah.
For us, that was Fridays, I think, with curriculum changes.
Still Fridays.
Is it still Friday?
I have no idea.
I heard sometimes they have tests on Mondays. That's like, what that
I
sounds terrible.
But at the same time, you know, if it was a bad week, you might be wanting to catch up on your panoptos during that time. So.
All right, Jenna. Well, I hope we've answered a little bit of your question. I think that it's been so long since we did a real relationship show that we should probably schedule one In the next couple of weeks. So,
get people that are actually in relationships.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, also just to sort of cover the issues a little bit more completely, because I know there's plenty of people in this med school who are in relationships and probably have a lot to say about it, other than just the basics that we covered, because there's a lot more to talk about. So we will be back in just a second on the Short Code Podcast. You guys are all in the medical scientist training program, learning how to be scientists and MDs all at the same time. Well, not all at the same time. So the way this works is, you know, you do the first couple of years of med school, you know, sort of, you know, get that that basic science learning under your belt. And then you move on to do some research, and then you come back and do your clerkships. So you go out into the wards and stumble around because you haven't thought about medical school in a while. All you've been thinking about is a tiny portion of medicine for a long time.
Yeah, kind
of. And when you graduate, you have both an MD and a PhD, and you hope, and you probably become academic medicine people.
Yeah, well, and ultimately you can do whatever an MD does or a PhD does. So there are people who move to industry. We could teach. We can do anything that either of those titles allows, I guess.
Okay. Well, you're here to... I asked you to come in today because you guys had a retreat recently. All the MSTP students get together and have this retreat. And the topic... of the retreat in part was science fiction. I thought, oh, that's pretty cool. Since you guys are, you know, supposed to be at the cutting edge of things. So explain why this was the topic aside from that.
So each year, I'm one of the members of the retreat committee. And so each year we try and come up with a fun topic that can kind of tie things together. And so we were ultimately throwing around ideas, and somebody just threw out science fiction, and it kind of stuck in that it allows us to not only look at what science we're doing, but what has inspired our science and where we think our science could potentially go in the future.
Yeah, totally cool, because I feel as though sometimes we're living in the future.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah. I saw a guy just, like, I was looking at my phone, listening to my headphones, like, just flipping through things on the internet as a guy rides by me on a motorized scooter, like, this morning, and I was just like, where am I? this is something out of, like, an old
scooter,
school science.
And the scooter was going...
Eventually, once they're hover scooters, I'll buy one.
That would be awesome.
Yeah,
because we have things that okay. So I remember when I was a kid, you know, I was thinking, oh, in the year 2000, I'll be 30. That is the future right there. Now I'm 45, and it's like, you had no idea. We have robotic prosthetics controlled by thought. We have exoskeletons for people who can't walk.
You were going to say without skeletons.
People without people born without skeletons. We have University of Pennsylvania researchers who have engineered transplantable. So this is crazy. They've engineered transplantable living nerve tissue to encourage regeneration in animals. What they do is they have two plates with nerve cells in them, and they encourage axons to grow in between them, and then a little motorized contraption pulls them apart slowly so that they lengthen the axons until they can use them to bridge transection of some nerve or something like that. I think the sciatic nerve is what they were working on.
Okay.
Which I thought, oh, that's fantastic. We recently talked on the show about researchers who stripped the cells from monkey's arm and replaced them with human progenitor cells to make an arm.
That's awesome stuff. To remake
an arm.
Yeah.
All sorts of crazy stuff. What was your... And you guys did what they called media talks during this. So explain the media talks.
So our idea with the media talks was to allow us to not only talk about our science, which is cool, but also talk about some of the crazy, amazing stuff that people are doing outside of our labs. And so we each picked kind of a topic that maybe seemed like it could be science fiction.
And it's really interesting when you start digging around. There is so much cutting edge work that people are doing.
And we only see a small fraction of it as it's coming to light.
Right.
What was your talk, Eric?
So I was talking initially, I guess, when I was asked to do this, I immediately start thinking, you know, science fiction, cyberpunk, you know, bionics, cybernetics. And as it turns out, there is an enormous amount of work being done in this field. Like you were saying, exoskeletons to help rehabilitate people, neural interfacing with like bionic limbs that actually goes both ways, like where you can actually transmit sense from the limb. So a lot of people have had bionic limbs and things for a long time, but now you're actually able to sense stimuli in that limb.
That's crazy.
Incredible. Yeah. That's crazy.
Having the feedback.
But they've actually had a monkey hooked up to electrodes on its brain control a robot arm on the other side of the world in Japan. I just think that's insane.
And you know they just did that because it's like...
Why not?
We can.
What the heck?
Leave it to Japan, too, with the robots.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
It actually controlled a sex bot in Japan.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. Don't put it past them.
But I ended up focusing in on the advances that people have been doing with the eye, actually.
So
fixing essentially people being able to take people who once were able to see, but through degeneration of photoreceptors now have completely lost all vision, and then trying to directly stimulate the retinal ganglion cells in order to allow them to see kind of crude objects.
I understand that at this point, there's only so far they can take that right now, because if the nerve has degenerated to the point where it's not working, obviously you can't just, do these things. But, you know, hey, if you put some of these different, like the motorized neuron stretching device, you know, I could see where you could take, you know, say, retinal implants and combine that with a sort of neural therapy or whatever you want to call it, and make somebody sort of see again. Do you know anything about the experience of what this is like for patients who, or for subjects who have done this?
There's actually, if you start looking around, some cool news features on this, and I think it probably differs between people, but for a lot of people, it's what they're seeing is not anywhere near what you or I can see. But for somebody who has been blind for several years, like the emotional impact of suddenly being able to see like a crude signal that to them represents, you know, their spouse or something like that is very meaningful.
Yeah, I mean, any degree of reorientation just in the world from completely nothing would be amazing.
The way I've explained this kind of bionic eye, it's like the cochlear implant for the eye. Mm-hmm. So it's not as good as our hearing, but it's something, and so it helps you. It's just a quality of life improvement, even if it's not good enough to drive or good enough to be able to see small details or read, it's still helpful. Mm-hmm.
Although I will say with the cochlear implants, even listening to music through one of the most advanced cochlear implants is like terrifying. Like it just like sounds like.
Well, it is, but it's historically it's improved so much just because of the technology has improved, and the bionic eye will continue to do that because the cochlear implant works by stimulating the auditory nerve cell, but it's not specific enough to just stimulate one nerve cell like a cochlear hair cell would. Sorry, I researched hearing, so you picked...
Oh, good. I'm sparking discussion.
And so one of the downsides of the cochlear implant is that it will end up stimulating multiple nerves, which would normally correlate with multiple frequencies, and so you get kind of a sort of
the resolution is very poor,
and it takes a long time to learn how to distinguish what a sound really would mean.
Whereas maybe with the retinal implants, are they more closely correlated with individual stimulating individual neurons?
I think it has the same limitation that right. you're stimulating a bundle of neurons in that field, and for that right. reason, you're not getting the same sort of color or the same sort of resolution.
So instead of just like stimulating one cone cell, like a regular photon would do in your light would do in your eye, you get like a whole little circle of them that ends up. And so you've got kind of a patch of light here and a patch of dark here and a patch of light here. And so eventually
sort of circular,
right,
roundish,
right,
pixels.
Yeah. And I mean, in the eye, how it works is when like you said, a photon of light hits one of those cells, there's a lot of amplification just built mm-hmm. in. So like one cell will activate 10, and then each of those 10 cells will activate like 100. So like it'll just keep amplifying.
And there's lateral inhibition as well.
So when when you're not getting so specific with like a single photon, there's a lot of things going on.
And that's actually one of the main ways that this field is going to advance, even with the cochlear implant as well. Mm-hmm. The technology hasn't changed in terms of electronics, but in terms of the computations
yeah.
that are done in order to turn a signal into something that's recognizable.
Yeah, processing is has been the big. So my wife works with cochlear implants. I know a little bit about it, and so processing, as I understand it, has been one of the big changes. In cochlear implants.
And since the retinal implant is relatively brand new compared to the cochlear yes. implant, which has been around for like 50 years. The amount of work that needs to go in, and now taking it from what's one dimension along the cochlea into two dimensions.
But I like how one of the images that you showed during your talk, it looked exactly like Geordi LaForge's visor from Star Trek.
I think
it's one of those interesting situations where
you need to work on the industrial design component.
Oh yeah, it's so awkward because you have this externally mounted camera, like on a pair of glasses, and in order to see a different visual field, you're rotating your head as opposed yeah. to just moving your eyes around.
Okay. It's like, you know, one of those interesting cases of, you know, art imitating life, imitating yeah. art, you know, like kind of.
Yeah.
Christina, what did you, what was your subject?
So my topic was regenerative medicine, specifically growing organs. And my inspiration was actually a Star Trek movie. So, Star Trek IV: Voyage Home. There's this. If you're not as nerdy as me,
among the best Star Trek movies,
is that the one with the whale?
It is, exactly.
Oh my gosh.
So the basic plot is that alien, they come and they basically they have to go back in time and bring a whale forward in time so that the Earth doesn't get destroyed. Mm-hmm. But there's this one scene where Dr. McCoy is in I think it's supposed to be mid '80s hospital, and there's this woman laying in the bed, and she's obviously uncomfortable, and he asks her, "Why are you here?" And she says, "Kidney dialysis." And he says, "What is this, the Dark Ages?" And he gives her a pill, and she grows a new kidney.
Yeah.
And so when I was thinking about these talks, I was like, oh, that would be a great one. And then I got to do it, which was really cool. And so what I did was I connected that to some research that's being done at Wake Forest in their regenerative medicine program, specifically a TED Talk by Anthony, I think it said Atala,
yeah.
Where they're working on growing organs for people specifically. And so the really exciting one is that they're using 3D printers to print kidneys.
So what are they printing the kidneys out of? I mean, I'm assuming it's not ABS plastic or...
No, so it is partly... They do use some polymers in their printing as structure. But what they'll do is they'll take a patient's cells, either skin cells, and turn them into induced pluripotent stem cells or iPS cells, or they'll take actually a sample of the organ that they're trying to reproduce, and then they culture those, and so they have them divide so they have a lot more cells, and then they actually print the cells. They put the cells into the printer, and mm-hmm. the cells get deposited where they're supposed to be. And so right now what I've seen, the highest complexity they can do is two different types of structure, so some sort of polymer or something in two different types of cells. So they're still working on it, but it's just amazing potential, I think.
Do these pluripotent cells end up forming glomerular-like structures and things in these?
That I'm not sure. I don't think that they have enough cell types to form a functional kidney yet, but they're working on it because, I mean, in the kidney, the cell localization is so important, and so I think but they started with simple organs, and now they're getting more and more complex.
So I'm completely fascinated by 3D printing in general. I've mentioned it many times on the show. I can't stop talking about it. But what is the is there a benefit that they see out of 3D printing rather than the technique whereby they sort of wash out the cells or the cells from the surrounding intracellular matrix and then repopulate that intracellular matrix with new cells?
They're actually using that technique as well. They've been focusing on liver stuff with the washout. I think part of the reason why the kidney, they're doing 3D printing, is most likely the localization. They'll be able to control better where they put each cell type, as opposed to if you just like wash them in, how are you going to control if cell A goes here or there?
Sure. I speak the washing out of cell reminds me of this new brain imaging technique that I don't know how new it is actually, but it's called Clarity.
Good branding.
Yeah, I mean, I think you want to have Clarity.
It's catchier than naming your brain imaging project like Merck or something.
So what they do is they wash out the lipids. Mm-hmm. And then they replace it with some sort of hydrogel. And what it does is it preserves the connections. So usually when you're talking about brain imaging, you're talking about slices of brain. And those slices destroy the, I guess what I've read is called the connectome, you know, the connections between the different portions of the brain. But now they can keep those
these
connections.
These own words.
Yes, I just make up words. So they can then study how the bits of the brain are connected, not just in sort of a macro sense, but in a really very micro cell by cell sense, which I think is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
They just have to do that in live people, and that would be. I would love to have a clear brain.
Yeah.
Well, but if your head isn't clear, then you won't be able to see it.
We all need some clarity.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's pretty cool. What were the other media talks? What media talks did you guys get to?
So there's also a good one on AI. I thought was really interesting.
Marie gave a good talk.
Yeah, and she talked about. I mean, obviously, artificial intelligence is something that impacts far beyond just health and medicine. So hers was more broad than the other ones that seemed to be a little more medically focused. But
and who was the person who did this again?
Marie
Kim.
Yeah.
All right.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, she basically touched on what's available in AI right now, but she focused a lot about kind of like where AI is going and what
the different theories on where it's going.
Yeah, and like even like when people are predicting we'll reach certain stages of it, and it was really interesting. I mean, I'm sure you guys remember some details. Do you remember anything that was cool that was mentioned from it?
Well, I
know one thing I thought. I mean, sorry to interrupt you, but one thing I thought that was interesting is she was talking about kind of like the end stage AI, like the one that's even smarter than humans.
Mm-hmm.
She mentioned is like better at us than everything, including social skills,
right.
Which I thought was funny that I'd never really thought about. That not only will this AI be able to calculate things better than me, but they'll also just be able to charm me more than I could even imagine.
Yeah, we'll be totally
that's the really scary.
Yeah.
Right.
Mark and I were talking a little bit about how, you know, maybe this, you know, because there's a lot of science fiction about how, okay, this super powerful AI is going to emerge and it's going to exterminate all human life. But Mark and I were talking about, you know, if this AI is really clever and has really good social skills, like far greater than we can imagine, you know, what if it invents some super meme? It's just like so viral that it just breaks people's psyches.
Oh, yeah, it doesn't need to take over by force.
Yeah,
it
just, yeah. Right. It's going
to... We just hand over everything. To
Are we certain this hasn't already happened?
Yeah.
We're actually just all on a virtual reality playground.
or an advertisement that, like, you watch the advertisement that has 100% success rate and people buy it. You know, like, there's kind of this internet meme. It's like, take my money now. And
that's
you're just kind
too
of like,
powerful.
Yeah. Type of thing.
So along these lines, you know, I've read quite a bit about Watson, mm-hmm. IBM's Watson.
Right.
I don't know, do people actually, are you guys interested in this?
There's
idea?
Actually,
yeah, well, you know what they've been using Watson for now is making medical diagnoses.
Yeah, yeah.
That's like what
there's also
doing
a creepy dinosaur toy that you can buy now. It's connected to Watson and it will listen to your child and then talk to them for you.
What?
Yeah.
Now wait a minute. Isn't this the topic of that AI movie by Steven Spielberg with Haley Joel?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah,
creepy kid.
Yeah, so it's like the new version of like a terrifying Teddy Ruxpin type toy. And it has like a weird Yoda voice that you can't really understand very well. Like it is, if it went off during the night, I don't think your child would be playing with it again.
Furbies alone really disturbed me when they'd go. People, you guys remember like the whole Furby thing?
I do.
You were supposed to be able to lock them in a closet and they'd go quiet, but every once in a while.
Well, that alone, like I don't think they had an off switch.
No, you had to put them to sleep.
Yeah, or destroy them.
Yeah. I remember a time when
and like in the middle of the night, they'd like from your closet be like just saying Furby stuff, and you'd like open it and like one eye's flickering unevenly from the other, and their mouths are just opening, and you're like, where? Like, what is going on? Like, this thing needs to be in the trash can.
Yeah, this is called the Uncanny Valley. It's like a well known topic in cybernetics where if something is like, Mark Torrell, completely acceptable, mm-hmm. C-3PO. Also acceptable because it's kind of robot-like. But
it's
something
far enough
between,
away from much like being Mark human. Right. Like once you get closer, it's creepy.
So I'm gonna go out on a limb and say that we're not there yet. I mean, I just got rid of a 2009 Dodge Caravan SXT. This is the Lear van. Okay, so it's got all the bits. Everything is computerized, right? But I would come home, like the other day I was walking home, my van was sitting in the driveway, and the door was just like opening and closing by itself.
And
the windows, sometimes I come out of the house in the morning and the windows are all rolled down.
What's the name of that Stephen King story where it's a car that like kills
Christine.
People? Christine, yes. So you had a Christine moment,
I did,
basically.
I did. So I don't know. I think we're a distance away at least.
Yeah,
at least, but the problem is you if you create a machine that then knows how to create a new machine that's better and then knows how to create a new machine.
That's
the idea of the singularity is that eventually it'll go so fast that you can't stop it.
Big point of talk.
And that's I think a lot of it is like we say it's far off now, but like every like look back at how quickly things have changed because it is exponential.
Like,
so
exactly. Computational power is just like doubling every year.
Yeah, there's like a specific law for it that it's like every
is
I forget
Moore's?
What is it? No. I think it is. Isn't it Moore's law?
Maybe.
I think it is.
Mm.
Well, that specifically talks about how quickly computational power advances, and I think it's been like pretty accurate.
I read a great book about this. Great science fiction book. Do you know Diamond Age? Fantastic book by Neal Stephenson. And it centers around a young girl who is given a book, a sort of nanotechnology
book. Kind of like
book.
Victorian.
There's some Victorian elements to it.
Neo-Victorian, yeah.
But it's like, it's you know, nanotechnology is so pervasive, is so everywhere. That, you know, you're literally surrounded by clouds mm-hmm. of computing all the time. And this girl is given this book that learns from her and she learns from it. And, Anyway, it's an amazing book, and I'm thinking about it because I'm reading about Cognitoids, the dinosaur connected to Watson toy. Oh, as the child begins to play with their dino, Cognitoids will slowly adjust its content and experience based on how the child is using the toy, vocabulary levels, interests, etc.
I think what they're really getting at is that they want data from children, and they're trying to sell it. No, this is great for your child. Like, it's also really good for us, but it's great for your child.
It's probably some terms of service that is just like so disturbing.
Yeah, I know.
Like, we will take pictures of your child.
That's one of the terms of service you really want to read.
Without your consent.
Targeted advertising.
Your child may evolve.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that Marie mentioned, but she didn't discuss extensively, is it's like a lot of the AI stuff, I think, will depend on what kind of motivations the AI ends up having. Because, I mean, a lot of human motivation is, like, improving our lives, continuing on our families, stuff like that. And who knows what AI is going to, quote-unquote, want. Mm-hmm. And so I think...
They may not be driven. I mean, evolutionarily, the idea is like, okay, make more people.
Right.
Like, we're just like, you know, that's the program that we're running, unfortunately. And you know, these AIs, they may have a completely different prerogative
or
agenda, you know.
Well, and I mean, when you're an AI, it's not like you have to worry about reproduction, because if you're just there for as long as you want to be there, then there's...
And what are the comforts, like, for a nice lifestyle that an AI desires?
What does an AI want? I don't know.
Some people that have a more gloomy approach to AIs have said, well, look at what the optimum functioning for a computer is. It's like cold, like no dust particles.
Yeah.
No
like,
oxygen.
The Earth is just going to be, like, purged and glassed, and it's going to be cold. It
actually,
should be, like, optimal functioning.
Going back to the whale thing, so the whole plot of that movie
it was a seminal.
I wish I spoke whale.
Yeah, they probably have a language.
yeah, right.
I feel like the plot of that movie was kind of ripped from the thoughts of John Lilly, who's a kind of out there fringe scientist, and he. At the beginning of his career, he was a physician scientist, and then later in his career, he discovered, like, LSD and ketamine and sensory deformation tanks. And he kind of, like, posited, like, maybe there's, like, some, like, dolphin whale consciousness that I need to learn how to communicate with. And so, basically, like, through all of these types of experiences, he eventually came to, like, he had this, like, prescient vision of a future where, like, a super intelligence evolves that doesn't need oxygen and doesn't need any of that kind of stuff, and it basically like all organic life on Earth is eliminated, and he calls it the solid state intelligence, and this is his apocalyptic vision. Anyway, if you're interested, read John Lilly's The Scientist.
Wow, that's
yeah,
that actually is kind of prescient, isn't it?
Yeah, he's nuts.
If we follow that,
a lot of LSD.
Yeah, exactly. I'm
going to say that. I'm going to say that in general, for a scientist, it's probably not a good idea to get involved in LSD and amphetamine.
Yeah,
using these things.
I'm wondering how the grant got funded. It's like, so I want to talk to whales.
Yeah,
and
it's like, but hold on,
But it was he got research money. I think it was from the Navy because they were like, okay, if we can talk to them, we can say like, carry this bomb jacket to this ship and blow it up.
Wow, that makes sense.
Which is just so perverted and awful. But.
Which means okay, yeah, no problem.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the medical things, though, because I just wanted to. I just wanted to point out that, you know, maybe some of the things we should be looking at are less technological and more sort of focused on the people in medicine and the way that medicine is practiced and works these days. I ran across this. This quote by this interview with Malcolm Gladwell, who is a...
I love Malcolm.
Yeah, he's a pretty cool guy. Journalist, big thinker kind of guy. Was interviewed on Medscape, on one of Medscape's video shows. But anyway, here we go. Listen to this.
So I have an 85-year-old mother. What does my mother want from the medical profession? She uses far more the medical of the healthcare profession than I do, right? What she really wants is an individual physician in her life who knows her well, who listens to her, who she trusts, and who can, she can periodically have extended conversations with, right? It matters less to her that she has access to world-class, cutting-edge technology because she's 85.
Yeah, yeah, right? Sure.
What she really wants is someone who just can guide her through what is becoming an increasingly complicated, confusing, and terrifying period in her life. She doesn't need just need someone capable of having those kinds of conversations with her. She needs a system that allows that physician to spend 25 minutes with my mother when she needs 25 minutes. Right now we have a system where finding 25 minutes twice a year is really, really hard.
You got it.
Right? So you can't, we can change the structure of who we select for medicine all we want, but unless we change the nature of medical practice, it's pointless.
So I don't know. I thought that was a good point because as much as we can advance science, as much as we can advance our understanding of what's happening in the human body, as much as we can advance our, as look to the future, today's research day. Here at the College of Medicine, lots of students did research this past summer and are, sort of showing it off today. And I was looking around and very few of those things had anything to do with the process of delivering medicine. Lots of it had to do with basic sciences and understanding, all of which is very important. But, I'm wondering, I would love to see for Medical Student Research Day anyway, and probably in general, a lot more looking at the problems that medicine faces as a system.
Lots.
Yeah.
Well, that's actually interesting, and it's actually something that we started to address this summer a little bit. Some MSTP students actually came together for sessions with a business professional who walked through some research that people with kind of more of a business perspective have on how we should structure a system so that there is more sort of continual interaction between a single doctor and a single patient.
Well, it's just something to think about, I think. And we'll be back in just a second on the Short Code Podcast. Before we go, I wanted to share an article I found. The International Business Times has an article on why millennials avoid seeing doctors and what this means for rising healthcare costs. First of all, shut up, millennials.
Yeah.
I don't even mean that. Shut up, media talking about millennials.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's what I really mean.
I mean, millennials are also currently the younger generation rather than like some permanent fixture who like tend to not have as many healthcare problems. So like millennials like in 60 years they're not going to be the same.
They're freaking out. The International Business Times is freaking out. They're sounding the alarm. Y'all aren't seeking medical help when you need it. What's wrong with you millennials? That could jeopardize your long-term health, they cry. It starts off with this anecdote about a 25-year-old who didn't seek help for a stomach ache, waited 4 days, searched the internet, was uncomfortable, made some calls, made an appointment with the doctor, and by that time the bellyache resolved itself. It's a fantastic story to illustrate why people should be seeking medical attention. Surprise! Millennials don't visit the doctor like other age groups do, they conclude. So they search Dr. Google. What? I don't know. This is nothing new.
Mom does this. Yeah. She's not a millennial.
I did this when I was 25.
That's
what
I'm saying. Is this like 25-year-olds? Like more than
when I was the millennial of my day. Like we called them. We were called Gen Xers back then. I did not seek out medical attention when I was sick. In fact, I've mentioned on the show I had Guillain-Barré syndrome. Mm-hmm. It took me. I went to the hospital like three times. But before that, I was like, hey, my face is numb. We'll just see what happens.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yep. So, I just want
to... I think that kind of touches on the issue of, like, our healthcare system in general, though. Like, a lot of people don't describe what America has as much as a healthcare system as a health crises management system. Because you're not actually, like, providing long-term preventative, like, healthcare, really. You're more like, if your appendix is hurting and it's, like, going to rupture, you'll... I mean, there's no better place to be in the world. Like, you'll take care of that, but...
Yeah.
For all the other things, like regular checkups. Like, I mean, I'm 24 now, and I'm wondering, like, oh, should I, like, be going to get regular checkups?
Yes.
Like, I don't know. And, like, one doctor told me no. Like, you don't.
Don't come back.
So, like, I, and that, like,
you're
really,
too healthy.
Yeah, that really struck me. And it's like, well, this seems like, isn't a whole issue right now, preventative care? Isn't this in direct conflict with it? So.
But then, on the other hand, we've been told recently that, you know, regular checkups might not be necessary.
Yeah, so... No.
Don't come until you have a
but
problem.
I mean I wonder,
I'm a little confused.
I see, my concern is I wonder if the advice to get rid of regular checkups is out of concern of like healthcare costs, and I feel like that's completely misplaced, because I mean it's a tough topic to address, but the majority of healthcare costs come at end of life when like people are looking for every option to stay alive. And I mean, like, I'm not saying that's wrong, but the reality is that we're not addressing that. And these things like cutting little costs here and there that is not addressing that is not going to change anything. And in fact, it's going to strip the healthcare system of things that might be working and like the cost is worth putting into. And I think that the end of life issue is, I mean, it's where like, I've seen data on it before, and I can't think of it right now, but I know that it's a vast majority of the actual cost comes within, like, the last, like, year of life. And it's something that I think no one's talking about.
So if those damn old people would stop, you know, getting old...
See, I'm not blaming anyone, but I'm...
The International Business Times has a few words they want to share with you.
Yeah, well...
Yeah.
It's something that I think needs to be talked about more.
Yeah. Well, we're out of time. I would just like to thank you guys for joining me today to talk about the future.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Come back anytime. If you like what you heard on the Short Code Podcast today, leave us a review and some stars on iTunes or Stitcher. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to tell us about your moment of truth. If something strange or wonderful happened to you, if you're annoyed or pleased about something, or if you want to suggest a story idea to us, leave us a message at theshortcoat.com. Do follow and talk to us on Twitter so we can all stay up to date on what's happening at the margins of medicine. The show is made possible by this strange world we live in and a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine, Student Government, and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our intern is Corey Christensen. Our opening music is by Dr. Vox, and our closing music is by C2C. Talk to you in 1 week.